Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Hawk Amana L. Bay. And this evening, we will be dealing with the Illuminati, the Heart Weapon, and alien visitation to this planet. We're going to be dealing with such questions as, what is the agenda of the Illuminati? Are the Illuminati connected to alien and UFO visitations to Earth? What is HARP? Can HARP be used for a weapon? Is the United States and other countries involved with aliens from other worlds? What caused the massive earthquake in Haiti? What caused the superstorm that hit New York City? What is Agenda 21? What is the global DNA database? These questions and much more we're going to be dealing with this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Keep in mind that we are bringing information directly from Tahaka's archives. We're only going to give you part of this information today because the plugs are too long inside the library, and we cannot upload them to this broadcast. However, you can go in and get the whole story and from several different angles by going to taharkaarchives.org. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A, archives, A-R-C-H-I-V-E-S.org, and get the information in its entirety. I've done a lot of research on this stuff and read a lot of information, but I thought it's very interesting, and I wanted to put it out here so that I can get you guys' opinion on it. And we are offering our free articles as usual. Let's not forget that. Just send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that right on to you. The Commerce Game Exposed, the 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game and How to Play, and Secrets of America. These are very, very important documents for us to understand in this day and age. And just send me an email and I'll rush that to you. Also, I made a mistake last night. On August the 16th through the 18th, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, the Morris Summit 2 will be held here. So for contact information, further information on that, just call me at area code 904-303-9061. Before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I get that to you. Now, the first thing I want to do is deal with some background information and so that we can get a clear and concise understanding about what we're about to deal with here this evening. And I'm going to let this guy, Alan Watt, he's going to come in, and he's going to give us a breakdown on that. And so pay very close attention to what this gentleman has to say. And this is before we began getting down into the information here this evening. Now, the HARP, it is real. We've done all the research on it. It does exist. It's right up there in Alaska, and is used for various purposes. But we want to find out exactly how and what it's used for, and how is that going to affect us, and how has it affected us in the past, okay? And so y'all sit tight, and we're going to listen to Alan here.
Here is part one of our interview with Alan Watt. Alan is an author, radio host, and deep researcher into the New World Order's long-term strategy of eugenics and more.
I'm Alan Watt, and I've been following politics and geopolitics for a good part of my life. I didn't start off deliberately going out to find out everything that was possibly going on. In fact, I had no idea, to be honest with you, how vast the scale of an agenda, a political agenda, is when you're bringing in a global society. Wars have many different purposes. Economics is only simply one big part of it, but cultural change and the building of empire through the defeated nations joining in leagues. Every country was basically signing the same laws, and had been in my whole life, at the same time that affected their societies. Laws were introduced and bills were introduced unbeknownst to the people in those countries that it was being introduced in their neighboring countries or even across the water somewhere at the same time. I realized there was already a governmental control, obviously, that coordinated all of this, and it led me into the United Nations. For every single department of government you have on a federal, local, county, state, provincial level, the United Nations had an equivalent department to deal with everything. It was already set up, in fact, to be global government. H.G. Wells said that the League of Nations, which was the embryo for the United Nations, he said this is the nucleus of the world's governments, when eventually all laws will come from there, be passed and signed into law by treaty of all the member countries. Eventually, we won't even have to go through the farce, and that's what it is, of voting in parties or candidates, because in the latter part of the 20th century and now into the 21st century, we're being trained, rather obviously, to simply accept rule by experts, rule by scientists, rule by professionals. And that's what they mean when they call governance. That's the term used. How do you get a domesticated herd to move from a field, a system in which it's been grazing for 20, 50 years, this kind of system, to this field over here, this new field? Because we have reluctance to change. We like familiarity. We like routine, you see. You do it by various techniques, one of which is revolution. Most revolutions are bloodless. You have cultural revolutions, sexual revolutions. Along with that comes the music revolutions, etc. These literally are designed to alter and direct culture, knowing what kind of culture they'll have at the very end of it too. They know exactly what kind of culture they want to come out of it. You also can do it through crisis creation. Crisis after crisis has been hit on the people of the world since 9/11 happened. And we must understand that the techniques that are used abroad are also used at home in warfare. And we heard the term shock and awe. Shock and awe on the hard force level, as they call it, is bombs, all kinds of acoustic equipment to nullify enemies, scare the hell out of them through voice to skull and so on, which was used in Gulf War I, and it's all over the British media. But you can also use shock and awe on your domestic people again. You do it by crisis after crisis until the public are so terrified. See, the average person has a sort of confidence that they build up where they think, I can manage most things that come my way. Whatever little crisis in my life, what happens to other people, I can deal with. When all those around you are getting scared at the same time as you because they're losing their jobs, they've been threatened with pandemics, terrorists everywhere, terrifying people to even get on subways, and so on, and all those around you, as I say, are also in the same boat, you tend to be more easily directed by the powers that be that come out and speak with authority and confidence over you. That's why they give you a guy like Obama, who's trained in oratory. He was trained in oratory, not in truth, but in oratory, the technique of persuasion. Shock and awe, as I say, is a technique of making a person and a whole population punch drunk And each one of those fears, you see, you understand, the average person can handle one major crisis in their personal life, maybe two at the same time. It's understood in psychology and many, many studies that if you have maybe three to four crises hitting you personally in your life at the same time, you will literally go into an incredible depression, a reactive depression. You can't cope. That's understood. Apply that technique on a whole population. The thing is, there's not one of these crises that we're being told about that you personally can do anything about. What can you do about terrorism if it really exists all over the place? It's out of your hands, you're helpless. What can you do about a coming pandemic? It's out of your hands, you're helpless. What can you do about a nuke getting set off in New York Harbor or wherever? You can't. You're helpless. The message you're getting is that you're utterly helpless to defend, help, or save yourself. That is complete shock and awe tactic that's been used not only in the US and Canada, but across the world. Same strategy, because we're already global with the global society running us all. Massive psychology and warfare techniques in psychology has been used across the planet to make us succumb to fear and crises, as I say, and none of which we can actually do anything about on an individual level. Therefore, the leaders are presented to us on screen with uniforms or business suits and ties as politicians who speak with confidence, all scripted, of course, and they seem to have everything under control. You're now basically a fearful slave looking up to the powerful master to defend and protect you. That's the simple technique of it. I've been speaking about the Rockefeller Foundation. I was mentioning the fact that in the United States, the Rockefeller Foundation, which also runs, I think it is the Carnegie Foundation today, maybe even the Ford, they're all combined. And the families that are given the intergenerational rights, if you like, or authority to lead the world to amalgamation under global governance. Mr. Rockefeller also is heavily involved in the world depopulation strategies. He funds abortion clinics across the planet. He also funds hundreds of other front foundations that you would think were independent from his, but they're actually front foundations. He funds them all through his money. You can trace them all back again to so-called family planning clinics across the entire globe, especially in the third world countries. It seems that Mr. Rockefeller is intensely worried about overpopulation in the near future from countries which will have no industry, etc., and he sees it as his right to start the decimating process, basically, of depopulation. Last winter, I got an invitation to attend something called the World Citizenship Council, the annual meeting. That kind of floored me because the head of the World Citizenship Council is Mr. Rockefeller himself. And here I am speaking out about and against them. So this did not come out of the blue. They try and get you on board working for them. What was also more startling was they always give members maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes to speak, and I was offered that to speak on stage to this world meeting. The world citizenship idea is part of the old idea of Cecil Rhodes up into Lord Milner to the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Rockefeller is up on Google in some of his conferences giving out World Citizenship Awards to very famous people. So they've already bypassed and have bypassed sovereign nations a long time ago. What other benefits you get from being a world citizen, I'm not certain at all. But I was allowed, he said I'd be allowed to speak at this conference. He did not say what to speak about, or didn't say anything about what not to speak about. And he also said that this chairman, of course, who wrote to me, he also said that I'd be allowed to participate in the round table groups which come after. The round table society is very, very important because the round table societies were set up as far back as the Milner Society and the Rhodes Foundation. They came out with the first round table societies. What they do is take the topics that are discussed at the main meetings, then they split off at different tables to specialize in certain aspects of the speeches they've heard and find ways how to implement them into reality through media promotion, various methods of propaganda, and so on. I did not attend. I was tempted to go just to see if they would ask me not to speak about certain things, but it was the middle of winter, and the journey to this university would have been pretty hectic anyway, and I was so busy. But you will be approached, and that's not the first time I've been approached to do this kind of thing. You'll find that some people are bought over. I should go back to Lord Bertrand Russell on this topic, because Lord Bertrand Russell said in one of his own books, the same book, in fact, where he talks about those children who manage to escape the indoctrinations, who have intelligence and an ability to communicate to others, must be brought on board the system, employed by the system, bribed into the system if possible. That generally works with most people. He said, otherwise we shall have to eliminate them, because they did not want people around who understood an agenda that the general public are unaware of. They didn't want these people with the ability to communicate information, documented information, in a fashion that people understand out in the community where they could spread this word. That ties in with Mao Zedong, who said he was not afraid of armies. His worst fear was someone with a good idea, a great idea, a unique idea, and the ability to communicate it. So that is how they treat, basically, people with information. First comes invitation to join them. Many people do. As I say, Bertrand Russell backed that up by saying if they can't be brought on board, they must be literally eliminated from the public arena. That's how seriously they take this agenda at the top. They don't mess it around. The reason I think they don't simply come out and kill you straightforward is they don't have to do a messy job. There's many ways of killing you, especially in this day and age. But I think, to be honest, they're so arrogant right now at this moment. They're not too worried about the mass of the general population who are indoctrinated and updated with their indoctrination daily from television, as one example. About 100 years ago, this big organization with many branches, they wanted to rule the world, basically using Britain as a nucleus of a system, an embryo, which also was going to be joined with the US under the Anglo-American establishment, wrote about the kind of culture and the changes of culture over a 100-year period that they would actually design. We're all tribal to an extent. That's why we even bother to vote for a tribal leader. This is well understood. That's why we're supplied with these leaders. And because the average man was to become more disengaged from his own destiny as the expert class arose, it was decided that the males would get their outlet, basically, gradually becoming helpless as males, through sports. Therefore, they'd have a tribal team they could identify with. They could cheer them on as they were winning. In their own personal lives, they were getting nowhere. They were getting disenfranchised, in a sense, as experts took over decision-making for them in all kinds of fields. So this was psychology at use, planned before they even implemented the sports. When radio came along, of course, they used that to the maximum. Sports for the men, radio soaps, basically, for the women. And then in came television, as I say, with its alpha state, its hypnotic state. It took off. It really, really took off. And men became glued to the sports shows. The big think tanks, and we've had think tanks to do with always planning the future and how they would create societies and even different cultures within 100 years, say, from this type of society to that society to the next society, how they'd implement it, again, always through the youth culture, which is easy to do if you have universal education. You can always mandate the same system, same culture to be taught to the youth. However, as I say, since the 1960s, once television really, really took off, sports used to only come out on Saturdays. And over a 10-year period, it gradually came on every night of the week. Until today, we have even sports channels, sports, sports, sports. And now you see guys who are sitting home, who are basically powerless at work. They have bosses. They're powerless on the roads. There's police and traffic wardens and cops watching them. They have no means to feel strong. And so they tend to watch sports as a substitute. They project themselves into a game which they never participate in.
Okay, Morris. I wanted to get that little backdrop out so we can get a gist of what we're about to deal with here this evening. We're talking about a group of people that is bent on corralling the world and controlling the world and creating different things and disasters and happening around the world to bring humanity to its knees and under their control. And this kind of thing has been going on for quite some time. And so we want to go now, after we have a little backdrop, into dealing with this thing step by step so we can understand what we're dealing with here. Now, I have a call on area code 832. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comment? Area code 832. Okay. Now, let us go ahead and deal with this.
It is out there. There is a force of people that just like control everything, and money doesn't mean a damn thing. Like, there's no price to what they do. There's no value. Don't believe what Obama's doing. Don't believe like what you see in the media. The media is like, you know.
Yeah, it's an illusion. At the end of the day, it's about power and control.
Yeah.
You know, they control the world. You know what I'm saying? It's already there. It's just a matter of like, you know, people wanting to be aware of it, make a game out of it, do whatever. It's just, you know, people want to know what's going on. In the age of knowledge right now, it's all about trying to figure out what's
you know
what.
Else, Lupe, they know that, you know, we don't read. Not just black people, but...
We.
Yeah.
Every, us.
Yeah. This section of, like, the world where people just don't give a fuck about what's going on. They
mm-hmm.
just depend on the news. They don't read. So all these losers out here at home playing video games, playing Call of Duty, wake the fuck up.
You idiot.
The way they got it is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the negativity's out there. The money's being...
Now, the top secret government project that can destroy the world. When aimed at the sky, it can change the weather.
With 1 billion watts, you can easily move a cloud wherever you wanted to move it using HARP.
When aimed at the ground, it can set off earthquakes and tsunamis. When it's pointed at you, it can literally blow your mind.
The general public are still blissfully unaware of it. That ELF that allows them to see deep in the earth and communicate with deeply submerged submarines is at the same frequency that the human brain works at. Brain waves really are, in part, radio waves. The brain can be influenced by external signals.
HARP is purely a research facility.
Yes.
So then what is the military doing there? Why is there so much military investment?
Well, as the military was involved because there was a... Let me back up and say the location of HARP was actually picked because that property was actually belonged to the U.S. Air Force, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that site was actually suitable location for that, and I believe that's one of the reasons for the military's involvement in the HARP program.
Weather manipulation. The ability to control the weather in specific areas. Mm-hmm. Is it possible?
It isn't even remotely possible.
The HARP researchers may not be as candid as they appear. They deny HARP can control the weather. He'll show how HARP's ELF radio waves can actually push around rain clouds in the sky, and in the process, change the weather. Dr. Agnew shows investigator Jun Sarpong just how easy the process can be.
When I turn the pulses on, this cloud should move from
yes.
bottom to top.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes. Oh, yeah, you can really see it.
It's almost like there's a wind inside the chamber.
So if this was the sky, you would see rapid movement into the sky.
Right. And this is
wow.
just a fraction of the power that's used in HARP. We're using about 100 watts in this little cloud chamber. HARP uses 1 billion watts.
The idea was by heating up the atmosphere, you could move the jet stream, bringing rain to places or taking rain away from places that were possibly receiving too much rain.
Robert says his father never intended for HARP to be used as an offensive weapon. But then the military saw the potential and bought up the plans.
Could HARP be used as an electronic weapon?
Certainly not.
Is there an example where HARP has actually been used in warfare?
Yes. In the first Iraq war, there's evidence that HARP was used to irradiate the battlefield prior to the invasion from Kuwait. When the tanks rolled into the area, the troops piled out of the bunkers. Not willing to give a fight, they gave up in mass.
These were the Iraqi troops.
And what exactly did HARP do to them?
It can prevent you from sleeping. It creates anxiety. It can even upset your bowels, how they work. And if it's played just right, HARP can be tuned to a point where it makes the recipient so paranoid, they begin to have visions like nightmares.
So it's clear the researchers want to avoid discussing the military uses of HARP. Son of a U.S. congressman, brother of U.S. Senator Mark Begich, he's been studying and investigating HARP for the past 15 years.
If we wanted to attack someone, we could actually, with HARP, attack them with the weather?
Right. And there's actually a treaty that goes back to 1977 that the U.S. and the Soviets and 60 other countries signed, saying we wouldn't use what they called environmental manipulation, which was things like creating tidal waves, earthquake, weather modifications as weapons of war.
Then what you're saying to me, point blank, is we quite potentially could be violating the treaty?
Well, the rule is you can do whatever you want domestically. That's the way the treaty reads.
All that may be dangerous enough, but Nick Begich says he's most worried about HARP's ability to interfere with your mind.
Obviously, they deny it.
Sure.
But what we produced was their own documents. You know, these are Air Force, Navy, military documents that actually lay this out. It's their own words, not our words.
You know, doctor, what you're saying to me is scary.
It is.
I mean, you're talking about something that can be done with mind control, to where you can affect people's minds and they don't even know it.
That's correct.
And this is masses of people.
Right.
They can do it at a level where you could be walking down the street and you could get infiltrated with these sound waves and you wouldn't even know that they were hitting you?
That's right. And there's two different ways. One would be transferring voice information, and the other would be just affecting you on an emotional level, which is much simpler, which is easily accomplished by HARP. The human body and the mind is able to pick a signal out. Like going through the radio station, you're dialing through the station, you get all the static. As soon as you get resonance, harmony between the transmitter and receiver, you get a nice clear signal. The same is true in terms of the human chemistry, in terms of our chemistry, our cell structure, body organs, or the brain.
I heard music,
right.
But it's strange because I listened to try to figure out where the music was coming from, and it seemed like right here.
Right.
It sounded like I was hearing
right.
It almost through the top of my head or my forehead.
Right. If you go back historically, back to the 1960s when all of this work really started, this technology is relatively simple. You can get the components off the shelf. You just have to have the technical knowledge to understand how to dial it in. Just like dialing in that radio station we were talking a while back. In between it's static, but when you get resonance between that transmitter and receiver, things start to happen. And in the earth, things start to happen. Where you already have something unstable, you can trigger that earthquake. This is the kind of thing that you can wage war without even knowing the war has been waged.
We saw how easy it is to move clouds around, to trigger storms, floods, eco-terrorism. And I learned that radio waves really can get inside your head. They got inside mine. Bottom line, I went up to the gates of the HARP facility, and they wouldn't let me in. An operation that's run by the Navy doesn't shut out a former Navy SEAL unless they've got something to hide.
Y'all ain't seen shit, but you already scared. Wanna know the truth, really, you don't. It'll blow you out your mind like a UFO.
For 22 and a half years, I served in the United States Army. I was on many occasions asked to serve as the official, unofficial UFO consultant dealing with UFO matters in the areas of my assignment. The United States government knew a whole lot more about UFOs than it was telling the American public. I was in the military, and I got to the point where I was no longer interested in trying to be part of the program and actually was going against the program. And I started to be very open and talking about what was going on. This resulted in every effort being made to try to destroy my military career. I even had an individual come up to me, point a gun at my head, and inform me we could have a training accident, and this would end this foolishness once and for all. We're exposed to the truth. We have a moral obligation to the UFO witnesses, the real victims of the UFO phenomena, to expose once and for all this policy and to reveal the truth, and that is, we are not alone in the universe.
I was assigned to the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe, And at that time, I was given a cosmic top secret clearance, which was and still is the highest level of security access that NATO has. I had access to this document. I had a chance to read it. And having been exposed to it, I must tell you honestly that my life has never, ever quite been the same. Because I read first-hand reports, verifiable NATO military material that indicated that the UFOs were not only real, but they represented something far beyond anything I had ever imagined before.
Strange and mysterious lights hovering above East El Paso tonight. What's even more strange, very similar lights were spotted in Manhattan just 2 days ago. Above the skies of Northeast and East El Paso tonight, a sight that was a little more than stunning. This is what one of our photographers, Ram Moreno, caught on video. One solitary light that appears to be falling in the sky. But that light suddenly breaks apart into two, then three separate lights. Those lights then just freeze in the air and begin to hover. Eventually, a fourth light can be seen. Then the lights appear to be hovering and then moving in a strange pattern. Now, you want to get really creepy? Check this video out. Just 2 days ago, in the sky above Manhattan, people froze on the street there as they saw these three lights hovering in the middle of the day. And check this out. The three lights are close to each other, then spread out into this triangle pattern. Now, look at the pattern side by side. This from Manhattan and the other tonight in El Paso. I gotta tell you, they do look...
They had concluded by 76 that some of these visitors very well might be multidimensional in their source. The evidence that we had collected and the evidence that they had repeatedly demonstrated to us, and that's no accident, it became very clear after a time that there was a program or a process of some kind underway, that they had demonstrated over and over and over again that they apparently were able to manipulate matter and time.
Then, they all disappear.
Now, this really shook up our scientists.
Four objects in the north, brightly colored, changing from elliptical to round, and moving at very high speed and sharp angular movements as though they were doing a grid search. While we were watching them, somebody else noticed to the south there were two objects just sort of hovering in the sky. One object approached us at very high speed. Best guess is 3,000 to 5,000 feet, somewhere in that neighborhood, stopped directly overhead and sent down a concentrated beam at our feet. It was about 1 foot in diameter. The best way I can equate it is sort of a laser beam. We stood there in awe. Was this a warning? Was this an attempt to communicate? Was this a weapon or just a probe? Just as suddenly as it appeared, click, it disappeared.
This latest video that we have is extremely interesting. I want you to tell us at home whether or not you think this is an abduction.
Take a close look at this. Field of cows?
Well, how do you explain that then? There you go.
That's an abduction.
That is definitely an abduction.
Intelligences from somewhere else, from other dimensions coming and going into our reality. It's been quite a shake-up in traditional science. I guess I speak out openly and bluntly about this because I feel so strongly about it. I violate my security oath every time I speak about it. I do it intentionally and I do it on purpose because I feel so strongly that the American people not only have a right to know the truth, but they have a need to know the truth. The truth, Don, apparently is simply this, that we're not alone, we've never been alone. We are apparently part of an infinite universe filled with intelligent life. Historical evidence indicates that they've been with us a long time. Don't like the word alien. I don't think the term alien is appropriate at all here. they had a hand in our being here. And I think the time has come where we're about to meet our extended family. It's going to be very soon, and the people are not ready. And one of the reasons I do speak out so bluntly and so openly is if in some small way I can help people get prepared for this.
A UFO hovers over one of the holiest sites in Islam, the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the spot where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, built on top of a site sacred to Judaism. An American woman takes it all in her stride, seen it all before.
We've seen them in Mississippi like this, but never like this.
Easily dismissed as a hoax until you see this. The same event, or so it seems, filmed from a different angle by someone else. The glowing ball of light dropping until it hangs just over the Dome of the Rock. These spectators a little more impressed.
Whoa!
People in American Fork and Highland reported some strange happenings in last night's sky.
They did, and they want to know what was hovering over that area between 7:15 and 7:30 last night. ABC4's Barb Smith is taking action to find out what it was, Barb.
Robert and Karen, they tell us that they saw lights, but those lights were not from an airplane or a helicopter, and these lights dropped something as they hung low over the sky.
Lynette Chittister doesn't believe in close encounters, neither does Mike Galbraith.
And when people tell me this, I think, oh, you know, it's... you're just seeing things, or people are making things up.
But last night, both saw something in the sky that they can't explain. Mike was in the Air Force and says the lights hovering in the sky were unlike any he had seen. He was outside a shopping center in American Fork, grabbed his cell phone, and took this video.
But I looked up, and there was three red lights, and then they started dropping, it looked like flares or something bright was dropping straight down.
I noticed over the roof of the garage a red light and a white light.
It looked like they were flying in formation perfectly together, and then the whatever was dropping looked like it was burning real bright.
If you have more video or information, go to our website at abc4.com and look for the orange box.
What would they be?
I don't know. They could be like balloons.
They might drop another.
What are they, really?
I have no idea what they are.
See, he's dropping a red, white something. They're probably bombs heading towards my home.
Where are they?
What is it?
I don't know.
That is a big threat.
And I don't hear any noise, so it's not like a helicopter.
People doing their halos. But, I don't see why they would be halos.
The ball suddenly shooting off as if disturbed. If it's a hoax, it's very well done.
My top side security guard called me on the telephone and reported a bright light that is a fully illuminated round object.
One of the people with me noticed some objects in the sky to the north. There were three or four objects in the north, brightly colored, changing from elliptical to round.
Was hovering silently over the missile silo and shining a light
at very high
down
speed
onto it.
And I don't hear any noise, so it's not like a helicopter.
The lights were without sound and did not belong to any plane or helicopter he was familiar with from his military experience. And he says what was being dropped were not flares.
They usually shoot out of the sides or they shoot down, and there's a lot of them. And you could definitely hear them.
Lynette's husband once manufactured military flares. He agreed what was being seen was not a military exercise. But what was it?
Once we have accepted it, and understood it and gone beyond the fear will bring about an expansion of consciousness in the human race.
You see, the American people are totally out of the loop.
Conspiracy theory to negate any good information that's out there. Does that mean that every conspiracy theory is a theory, or are there real conspiracies? I think we all know the answer to that.
The United States government knew a whole lot more about UFOs than it was telling the American public.
The general public are still blissfully unaware of it.
The government has obviously been lying to us.
When I found out there were 8 presidents before George Washington, I wanted to smack somebody. You know, I wanted to know why I was taught otherwise.
I feel so strongly that the American people not only have a right to know the truth, but they have a need to know the truth.
Time. It's time to speak out and go public with these things. Most of the conversation I hear on the internet and on the radio is foolishness. What I've told you is true. If you've noticed, I'm not selling anything. In fact, I didn't want to do this for years and years, and here I am because it's time. It's time to speak out. Time to be doing things. As we make it through each day, we should give thanks to God that we've made it another day. There are no guarantees.
Prophecy is what we all have to go by now.
Okay, Morris. Now, what do you think? You think there are UFOs out there? Or you think it's just a hoax? Go ahead and raise your hand and let me know what you think about them. We've heard a whole lot about it. It's been on the news, on your documentaries, and all this stuff. But what do you think?
So what they've done is Microsoft was set up so that there would be one global operating system that the U.S. government had a backdoor into for all computers everywhere in the world.
Right.
Then they set up Google as a search engine. And let's just look at the background of the two guys who supposedly set it up.
Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
That's right. Now, Sergey Brin he was born in Russia, so he's from an immigrant family. But listen to this. His father was a mathematician who worked at the University of Maryland, and his mother worked for NASA.
I didn't know that one. It's like a blueprint line.
NASA. And yeah. That is exactly where Sergey Brin and Larry Page park their private jets.
Of course.
Is at the NASA facility.
Mm-hmm. They don't have to go through TSA. Gosh, what a surprise.
Right. Larry Page is an American. His parents were both computer science professors at Michigan State University, and his father was one of the top experts in the United States on artificial intelligence. Now, Sergey Brin married a Polish-American woman called Anne Wojcicki. So as soon as Anne Wojcicki married Sergey Brin, she was given millions of dollars in venture capital the day of
the
wedding.
Yeah, I think she got $20 million just to start.
Right.
Right. All right, hold on. Loren Murray is our guest tonight, a longtime friend of good people everywhere on the planet. Her work on depleted uranium, of course, really knows no bounds and needs not much of an introduction. She's talked about it too many times to count around the world and on this program as well. We're talking about Google and DNA and control. Next time you hit the Google search function, just keep in mind that your finger is doing a lot more than simply looking up information. You're helping to propel a monster on the planet. It is a beast. It's unbelievable what's going on. Go ahead.
It's unbelievable. And what I want to emphasize is that Google, Microsoft, Facebook, and the social networking websites,
all of them.
eBay, Skype, Google Mail, Yahoo Mail, PayPal, these are all the same entity. They're all integrated. They get bought and sold and traded around. These are all U.S. Navy and military operations. Now, I know a physicist who told me that they were tracking people in the lab by the electromagnetic frequency emitted by individuals' DNA. In other words, every living thing is an antenna that transmits and receives. We're an electrical system, and the DNA in every living thing has a unique frequency and signal. That is what they're using, what they're focusing on, and what they're weaponizing to completely control us. The DNA Human Genome Project was carried out at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, where I was a staff scientist for 5 years. But the Lawrence Livermore Lab, Los Alamos National Lab, these are all nuclear weapons labs, were also involved. That means the military, because the nuclear weapons labs exist for the Pentagon, and the Pentagon exists for the oil company. So the Human Genome Project was set up and well-funded to experiment and to research and to describe the human genome. Now, how would they use that? Well, what we know about Google is that they are doing DNA surveys from space. This would be NASA and the Navy. NASA is run by the Navy. They have been tracking and identifying isolated populations, for instance, in the Amazon, who have never had contact with Western people. These are villages of isolated people who are still living their traditional hunter-gatherer lives.
Right.
And they've never seen a Westerner. That's not just humans. They are also doing a global species survey. And I've been tracking this for 2 years and noticed that many new species are being discovered. And it seems to be on a grid system. So they're doing a survey from space. And they went down the west coast of South America and then came up the east coast, and now they're in Southeast Asia. And if you watch in the news, about once a week they come up with a new article and photos on new species they've discovered. This is part of the United Nations Agenda 21 program, which is to identify all species and to do a complete global inventory of humans and animals. And what David Rockefeller has said about Agenda 21 is that in the end, we're going to have a chip on every person, and they will only be allowed to take out of the system what they put into it. If you work 12 hours a day, you're allowed to take 12 hours of something of value out of the system, but nothing more.
Hmm.
What is going on? The J. Greg Venter Institute, which mm-hmm. you sent me the article,
right.
Has their mission as, quote, to forge new life forms, unquote. And they are also involved in manipulated computer code on DNA. What does this mean? Well, Dr. Helen Wallace from GeneWatch in 2002 said, we are in great danger, and she described this as a massive DNA database by the back door.
Now, what this does sociologically, it begins to set up a caste system here, which we already have, but this is a different way of doing it. I don't know where it's all going to go, but it's clearly hurtling forward at a pace that is pretty damn scary, if you understand the potential of control here.
And what they're doing is using computing, medicine, technology, and the police state to converge into basically what is creating a totalitarian scientific oligarchy. And their purpose is to get this information and use it in discriminatory programs where the rich benefit and the poor are impacted negatively by these programs. And the second part of that agenda is the depopulation initiative. Now, a really good example about this biopiracy. Now, I did an interview with Dr. Wynn Parker. So on the air, I was talking about depleted uranium and the tremendous affinity it has for the DNA and mitochondria, because uranium and phosphate structures, they have a love affair all through the universe. And that means that when people are exposed to uranium particles from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yugoslavia, and by the way, it's over here in 2 weeks in the U.S., and we're inhaling it.
Sure, all the time.
It sticks to our DNA and our mitochondria that provide all the energy for the body.
Somebody made the decision to go ahead and use it against the people in Yugoslavia and then Iraq, knowing full well what would happen. And that's a party I would like to see brought to justice, whoever that was.
So as I was sitting there describing all of this to Dr. Parker, and I was talking about HARP, this is all integrated into the HARP system, I knew that Dr. Parker, Wynn Parker, was not his real name. I knew he was a CIA scientist. I knew he'd worked for the U.S. government, for the Department of Defense, for the World Health Organization, and the U.N. at different times. And I knew that he was a microbiologist who knew the whole field because he had to advise the government. And so I just said, Dr. Parker, what is the application of this discovery that nanoparticles are transmitters? And he caught his breath. And he said, well, it's to redesign the human genome.
That's all, huh? They're going to create a new species is what they're talking about here.
It's to create anything they want to.
Right.
It's to repeat anything they want to. It's this totalitarian, insane scientific oligarchy that's run by psychopaths. And they think they can do anything they want to.
Well, so far nobody's around to stop them, unfortunately.
Now, what is transmitting and receiving that's around us? Well, how about cell phones in the megahertz frequency band? These are some abstracts that I'm going to just read the titles of. This is 1996. Single and double-strand DNA breaks in rat brain cells after acute exposure to radio frequency electromagnetic radiation, mm-hmm. and they used the cell phone frequencies. DNA strand breaks in rat brain cells. So they're talking about sterility, about cancer, and about altering people's behavior. And the airport scanners are doing the same thing.
Wouldn't surprise me. I'm amazed that there's very little attention being paid to the electric grid. And as all of you listening know, it is surrounding you and everybody you know 24 hours a day. Your home, your office, it doesn't matter. It's called wiring in your walls. And that 60 hertz electric service that you rely on to power your goodies can also be used to carry any kind of telecommunication business you can imagine, and I would submit mind and behavior altering and control platforms as well. It's all doable.
It's very simple to do because we are electrical systems and we transmit and receive just like any other antenna.
We're electrical first and chemical second. We are electric beings.
That's right. And a lot of this was described in the 1930s in the lectures that Bertrand Russell gave at Oxford University. And I would like to read a paragraph, if that's okay.
Yeah, we have 3 minutes, so you have to hurry.
Okay. A totalitarian government with a scientific bent might do things that to us would seem horrifying. The Nazis were more scientific than the present rulers of Russia and were more inclined to the atrocities that I have in mind. If they had survived, they would probably have soon taken to scientific breeding. Any nation which adopts this practice will, within a generation, secure great military advantages. The system, one may surmise, will be something like this, except possibly in the governing aristocracy. All but 5% of males and 30% of females will be sterilized. The 30% of females will be expected to spend the years from 18 to 40 in reproduction in order to secure adequate cannon fodder. As a rule, artificial insemination will be preferred to the natural method. The unsterilized, if they desire the pleasures of love, will usually have to seek them with sterilized partners. In other words, Jeff, Bertrand Russell's message is that wild reproduction is no longer an option.
Yeah.
So basically, they have unlimited budgets. They have an unlimited scientific body in universities to do all this research. And today, over 50% of scientific research money in universities comes from the Pentagon.
Okay, Morse, let me remind you that what we're hearing here this evening is in its entirety inside of Tahaka's archive in video format, so you can actually see this. I selected the best portions that I could in short form in order to put it here for you this evening. But this is very, very important information for us to keep in mind. And the way to access that is just simply go to TahakaArchives.org. Now, we're going to go into another phase, but if any of you have any questions, any comments, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll open up the line so you can get in, okay?
Trying to be high more. You understand the better man more.
410.
Hello, there. Hello?
Tell us who you are, where you calling from?
Yes, this is Darius calling out of Wilmington.
Hey, Darius, what's going on?
Yeah, tonight's topic, visitations from outside our atmosphere. There's evidence for that. There's a mile-long spaceship on the moon. Inside the spaceship, there's a black woman piloting it, as if she did it through her faith, using her chakras. There's pyramids on Mars, numerous ones of them. Even a picture of the Great Sphinx. And the question is, are those our personal creators? Did they create us?
Well,
there's links with Mars and Earth connection. You know, with that DNA that female was just spoken about. I'm all too aware of it.
Well, I had to look at it in the position that we're in. How to be the only media and all the distribution of information through the radio, television, they control all that, the internet. So there is definitely a cover-up, and there's been a few scientists that got in and went against the grain that have brought out a whole lot of information, but the bulk of that information is not never allowed to be given to the public. And, of course, we as people of African descent has been completely written out of the history altogether.
It doesn't really matter, sir, because the people that's operating these ships look just like me and you. Take that one.
Well, I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it at all.
Yeah.
You got another question?
That's it. It was my comment for edification.
Okay,
you can pull it up. It's all over.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
Okay.
All right.
That's
thank
all
you,
the
brother.
Words. Peace.
Peace. Okay.
Jean Manning is a journalist who stumbled into a strange world when she started asking questions about alternative energy sources and heard the story of an early 20th century inventor named Nikola Tesla.
Tesla is almost a cult hero and an overlooked genius, and he has so many inventions that are at the basis of technologies that we have today.
She went to a conference on Tesla and had a close encounter with a mysterious scientific researcher who became her deep throat, her Mr. X.
He sent me a file of materials about the Bernard Eastland patent.
About a month ago, the U.S. Patent Office granted a patent to a Houston-based scientist, Dr. Bernard Eastland, for an invention which, Dr. Eastland says, could be used to change the weather. Dr. Eastland says the invention could also be used to disrupt communications all over the world and might be used to destroy or deflect a missile attack.
The Eastland patents had the ring of the mad scientist aspect of Tesla. Tesla talked about this Tesla shield around the planet and talked about particle beam weaponry, something called a death ray.
Death ray? Jean wasn't sure where all this was leading until Mr. X called again.
And he said, the maniacs are actually going to do it up in Alaska.
Mr. X's maniacs were in the U.S. Pentagon, and he was convinced they were conspiring to build Bernard Eastland's Skyzapper under the guise of a nice little research project deep in the Alaskan bush called HARP.
The basic concept is to build a very large antenna, then to utilize a large amount of power and to beam those radio waves up into the upper atmosphere.
Have you approached the Pentagon with this invention?
Yes, and what I'm not at liberty to tell you is the details of what that interaction has been.
The word spread through the Alaskan bush
And soon, a band of suspicious Alaskans set out to warn people about what they saw as the U.S. military's secret agenda.
And what you have with FARP is sort of the universal hammer for geophysical warfare.
Nick Begich is the chief conspiracy theorist.
So when did you know that you were onto something?
I think as soon as I saw the references to Tesla's work, and when I read Bernard Eastland's original patents, I realized that what we really had here in Alaska was a prototype for a ground-based Star Wars weapon system.
HAARP is a non-classified project run not by Bernard Eastland, but by the U.S. Army and Navy. The official HAARP story is told by one man, John Heckscher.
It consists of several types of transmitting instruments and numerous scientific instruments that study the natural ionosphere and the ionosphere that has been perturbed by the instruments that we are building.
The ionosphere is a sea of electrically charged particles in the upper atmosphere, and the instrument is a powerful radio wave transmitter.
Does it have any military applications?
The site itself is strictly a scientific research site. Perhaps the outcome of some of the science, perhaps some of the results, could be applied in a military to military systems.
Just a little physics project? Jim Roderick isn't buying it. He's been gunning for the real goods on HAARP, and his weapon is the Internet.
The military isn't capable of doing pure science. Science is conducted by them for application in weapon systems, for no other reason.
From his shack in the middle of an Alaskan village, Jim and his co-conspirators around the globe have been tapping into databases. They've dredged up hundreds of long-buried scientific reports and even some internal documents from the military. They call it the world's first techno-protest, and they did it all on the military's own baby, the Net.
Plans for HAARP activities correlate with projections of what can be done in the Eastland patents. It's that simple.
So it's not a coincidence?
It's not a coincidence.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, but it's not his patent that we're building. Superficially, yes. They send energy up into the ionosphere, but the Eastland patents require huge, prodigious, in fact, amounts of power, like 100 billion watts.
Remember that number, 100 billion watts. You'll hear it again later.
HAARP requires only 3 million watts.
There is a paper trail leading us back to Eastland.
No, there is not. There is no paper trail that I'm aware of that's leading back to Eastland. Eastland used to be an employee of the company which is building HAARP, but that's pure coincidence.
Is it also a coincidence that the tiny company that owned Eastland's patents was later swallowed up by an enormous military intelligence firm called E-Systems?
$2.1 billion in annual sales, $1.8 billion of that, with a B, was to military intelligence groups, CIA, NSA, and others. And of that, 800 million were black projects, so secret that even the United States Congress didn't know what they were.
E-Systems was then swallowed up by Raytheon Corporation. It, too, specializes in super-secret contracts with the Pentagon.
Why would Raytheon be so excited about this? Well, it's a ground-based Star Wars weapon prototype. For them, it represents potentially billions and billions of dollars.
So how would you describe this world of E-Systems and Raytheon and HAARP?
Dark.
There's a lot of people around here that have really a lot of strange ideas, and I think many of them are pretty bizarre.
Michelle Angbritson keeps the HAARP computers from freezing up in between visits from the military scientists.
Well, do you know? I mean, do you understand what they're doing here when the scientists come in?
You mean when the scientists come in and shoot the beams up? Yeah, they're shooting the beams up, and I think that heats a little small space in the ionosphere. And then you've got guys that are sitting on computers, and You've got people putting up weather poles that measure weather and everything like that. I mean, there's something spooky going on here.
There have been claims made by some scientists that that you could heat up the ionosphere and affect local weather.
If you were to do Eastland patents, I have no doubt that's the case.
Claims are being made that it could disrupt global communications.
Global?
That it, yes,
no.
that it could shut down another country's communication system and enhance your own.
Not HARP. Not HARP in
Alaska.
As it is
Alaska.
Now. No.
But you couldn't disable any systems?
Those that use... If the systems used a path which was accessible to the HARP beam, yes.
Starting to sound like Eastland's invention to you? Well, remember, John Heckscher says HARP has nowhere near the power levels Eastland talked about.
It seems like this entire thing has been a matter of disinformation.
Eric Nashland understands the military. He spent 15 years in the service as a radio engineer. He knows deception.
It came to our attention that there was a document, a technical memorandum, I think it was 195 or something like that. And reading right in the front of it, they said that, bottom line, although this is here, it does not constitute publication.
It doesn't exist.
It basically doesn't exist. So it was kind of like, wow, here's the document that doesn't exist. We're talking several hundred pages of document that, you know, doesn't exist on a project that is completely unclassified and open to the public.
We got it through friendly folks in the right spots, but it really lays out, these are notes from a conference that really break down where they were going to use this technology and how this technology was going to be applied.
Remember the 100 billion watts debate? Well, for Nick Begich, this document was pay dirt.
And in the document that we uncovered, the actual desired level of these researchers is 100 billion watts. And there we're talking something closer to the order of what Bernard Eastland envisioned.
You must be familiar with Technical Memorandum 195, which talks about a desired level of 100 billion watts.
Which memorandum?
Technical Memorandum 195.
I'm not familiar with that number.
Well, it's about 600 pages, and it's. I mean, you may not acknowledge it because it's not. It hasn't been published, but it exists. I've seen it.
I don't know what Technical Memorandum 195 is, because I haven't seen it.
This is a published document. It's non-released, and it's the word games that John Heckscher plays and the word games the United States military plays, and it's the word games they continue to play, and those are the things that need to end.
Zap incoming missiles. Disrupt global communications, and engineer the weather. And ready? There's one more. Some people believe the technology being tested here could be used for sinister projects involving humans. Radio waves messing around with people's brain waves. And guess what? The military denies this one, too.
The human mind is subject to being affected by radio frequency energy, and that's what this device is.
In other words, you can move the moods of large populations using this kind of technology.
So now we have not just maniacs in the Pentagon, but a bunch of Dr. Strangelove's? Pretty weird stuff. But scientists have been experimenting with radio frequencies on animals' brains for decades, and the military has followed it all very closely, especially once it found out the Russians were onto it.
It was all kept a deep, dark secret by the two superpowers.
Back in the 60s, the Soviets began zapping the American embassy in Moscow with a low-frequency beam. No one knows for sure what they were up to, but one theory is that they were trying to mess with people's central nervous systems. And one report did say the diplomats got depressed a lot. And hey, just think of all the nifty applications against the enemy. Why blow people up when you can drive them crazy?
From documents dating back into the early 80s, we see that the military had discussed the possibilities of mind control through radio frequency energy. The possibility is there. The military has studied it.
A 1982 Air Force report called radio frequency energy a major new research initiative and said that RF can, quote, disrupt normal purposeful behavior. A 1987 military report called for more research on RF energy as a non-lethal weapon, while pointing out that most of the existing technology is classified. And sure enough, in 1993, there was a big conference at Johns Hopkins University. Here, the entire conference was classified, but the agenda wasn't, and weapons using extremely low radio frequencies, or ELFs, were listed as a very attractive option.
Is it just a coincidence that there's been all of this talk and that HAARP will be experimenting with this? Is that all just coincidence?
I believe the ability of ELF to affect the mind is a side issue for us. It may be real, I can't say.
It's been exceedingly difficult to find information on what is supposed to be a major new initiative of the military. All we see is HAARP.
Well, then I'm being kept in the dark, if that's the case.
The question is, could they, would they? And we believe they can, and we believe they will. Somewhere, at some point, all of this technology merges at some level within the Pentagon, and it happens to be in Alaska, and it happens to be now.
It isn't just conspiracy theorists who are concerned about HAARP. In January of 1999, the European Union called the project of global concern and passed a resolution calling for more information on its health and environmental risks. Despite those concerns, officials at HAARP insist the project is nothing more sinister than a radio science research facility.
HAARP stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project and is described as a research instrument for studying the ionosphere. An ionospheric heater, or ionospheric radiation instrument, IRI, of which many exist, but HAARP is special. The ability to focus energy and the unprecedented amount in gigawatts, billions of watts, make it literally millions of times more effective at heating the region about 150 miles above the Earth's surface. The atmosphere has most of its density below 30 miles altitude. The ionosphere is the very thin layer above that absorbs dangerous ultraviolet radiation and makes life possible on Earth. There is very little mixing normally between the two layers, but disturbances in the ionosphere translate to changes in weather, such as normally occurring sunspots and the solar wind. The main idea behind HAARP is the ability to direct electrons along the naturally occurring magnetic field lines of the Earth and accelerate them to near the speed of light to form a protective shell of highly excited particles that not only block communications worldwide, but destroy missiles in their trajectory as they descend from space. The effects can be localized by punching a hole through the ionosphere to superheat an area 30 kilometers in diameter into a plasma shield. Any missile or aircraft would be destroyed that tried to fly through the plasma, which is the fourth state of matter. A hole in the ionosphere above an enemy country could kill by allowing the solar radiation to strike the surface of the Earth unhindered. Weather modification can also be used as an instrument of warfare by manipulating the electrojet and the jet streams which dictate climate. The publicly stated aim is C3, or Communications Command and Control. The margin of victory in war is to block or intercept enemy communications and to secure your own. The signals in the ELF range can be generated by HAARP and heard anywhere in the world and are used for earth-penetrating tomography, basically finding enemy submarines or underground bases. Volcanoes and earthquakes cause electromagnetic disturbances, and it is theorized that EM disturbances might themselves trigger earthquakes and volcanoes. Dr. Richard Williams says the high-energy experiments will generate the equivalent of the output of 10 to 100 large power-generating stations, and that tests of these kinds could cause irreversible damage, unquote. HAARP is the world's largest electromagnetic broadcasting station and may represent an escalation in the electromagnetic wars. The project is a creation of the U.S. Air Force and Naval Research. Publicly, it is an ionosphere atmospheric research instrument, but it can be used to control weather and do electromagnetic sweeps that can be used for mind control of large populations. HAARP, located 30 miles from Fairbanks, Alaska, is the real focus of anti-missile defense that SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, purported to be, and much more. The public patent was titled A Method and Apparatus for Altering a Region of the Earth's Atmosphere, Ionosphere, and Magnetosphere. Dr. Bernard Eastland, a physicist who holds a patent for the fusion torch, also holds about a dozen other related patents that were eventually purchased by E-Systems and Raytheon. Patent number 4686605 claims the following uses: cause total disruption of all forms of communications over a very large portion of the Earth, missile or aircraft destruction, deflection or confusion, weather modification by altering solar absorption, also altering composition of the atmosphere. This patent was classified by the Navy under National Security Order in 1987. But other patents exist for purposes of power beaming systems, artificial ionospheric mirror composed of a plasma layer, creation of artificial ionizing clouds above the Earth, defense system for discriminating between objects in space, nuclear-sized explosions without radiation. Dr. Yarrow states, Earth's axial spin means that a burst lasting more than a few minutes will slice through the ionosphere like a microwave knife, producing not a hole, but a long tear, an incision, unquote. According to Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher, the ionosphere is prone to catalytic reactions, so if a small part is changed, a major change in the ionosphere can happen. HAARP documents admit that 1,000-fold greater amounts of energy can be released in the ionosphere than are injected. Stanford University experiments beaming radio waves, very low frequency waves, into the magnetosphere detected the signals halfway around the world. Some were amplified 1,000 times. HAARP documents describe intentionally trying to get a runaway effect in the ionosphere. The instabilities commonly studied are approaching their maximum radio frequency energy dissipative capacity, beyond which the plasma processes will run away until the next limiting factor is reached, unquote. The first atomic weapons testing was done without knowing if the chain reaction would stop or keep going. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer admitted years later that, quote, the government knew that the scientists didn't know, unquote. The decision to pulse several gigawatts of energy into the ionosphere could cross a threshold. Walter Richmond wrote an account of such an event in a book entitled The Lost Millennium. The event began with a solar tap, a planetary short circuit. Quote, the surge of power became an avalanche. At the pole in the vertical plane of the Earth's magnetic field where the winds of magnetism would not rise to blow it out, 1 trillion watt seconds of energy unleashed their fury on the polar cap in the first flash. Even as it discharged, the ionosphere was recharged from the solar furnace. The first flash became a mighty roar that poured an increased and now steady stream of energy through the now stabilized short circuit. Kilocubit after kilocubit of frozen wasteland boiled. Watt after ever-increasing watt, an avalanche of ever-increasing energy lit the polar cap with a glare that had never been seen before on Earth. Earth's an electrical motor. When the motor began to run wild, it would increase its rotational speed. Eventually, the Earth would explode from increased centrifugal stress. Dr. Teller tried to sell Alaska on Project Plowshare, the use of 6 thermonuclear weapons to excavate a harbor at Cape Thompson, Alaska. In 1987, Dr. Edward Teller returned to Alaska to propose the installation of a laser-like weapon system on the north slope of Alaska. The weapon system Dr. Teller was trying to sell was classified and would not openly be discussed, but the presentations indicated this Star Wars weapon was, in fact, HAARP. In 1995, Congress killed funding for Star Wars, but HAARP continues as the ultimate SDI radio frequency radiation weapon. The HAARP project manager describes the experiment of earth-penetrating capability using, quote, frequencies of 10 to 20 hertz pulses per second, or maybe 1 hertz, 1 cycle per second type waves, unquote. This range of frequencies are the same dominant frequencies within which the human brain normally operates. Objections to non-disclosure of the biological effects of EOLF on living things were ignored. The military, particularly the Navy and Air Force, have extensive research on the negative effects of EOLF. These effects have been well documented, but the government easily deflects public concern by playing down the effects and minimizing the risks. This is the same method used for other military systems, including nuclear weapons tests, LSD experiments, and radiation experiments, all carried out on unknowing subjects under the guise of national security.
Okay, Morse. That is very, very interesting. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to start dealing with the aliens and UFOs. If any of you got any questions, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll open up the line. Your host, sit tight. If you got any questions, as soon as the segment is over, I'll go ahead and find out what's on your mind. Okay? Y'all sit tight.
Well, tonight in Los Angeles, Dr. Stephen Greer unveiled his film Sirius about the UFO disclosure issue. Also talked about this little 6-inch humanoid that they put on video. It's a documentary, and it was a sold-out crowd. So Dr. Stephen Greer will be with us tomorrow on Coast to Coast. In a moment, Len Kasten joins us as we talk about Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. It's an incredible story, and we'll have it for you next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Len Kasten joined the U.S. Air Force Aviation Cadet Program after graduating from Cornell. While in the Air Force, experienced a UFO encounter that had a tremendous effect on his life, although he didn't realize until a few years later. Then working in D.C. in the 60s, he felt drawn to join the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP at the time. NICAP was the most prestigious organization in the country investigating UFOs. He now writes for the New Dawn magazine, published in Australia and New Zealand. Len Kasten on Coast to Coast. Len, how are you?
George, how are you?
Good. I want to thank you, first of all. Last Monday, you were our scheduled guest, and you were kind enough to let us push you back a week because of that tragedy in Boston. And
yeah, that was appropriate. It was. Everyone was in shock anyway.
It was unbelievable. Truly unbelievable. So when I was a young kid, I joined NICAP myself. I loved it. I had my little ID card and everything.
Yeah, it was the organization to be in if you were interested in UFOs at that time.
It was just phenomenal, and that kind of jump-started.
They had the best investigative team of any.
Tell me about your UFO encounter.
Well, it all happened while I was in the Air Force. I was asleep in a barracks room, and at 3:00 in the morning, I suddenly woke up and jumped to the window. And no sooner did I do that than I saw this glowing green gold phosphorescent craft going by at a very high speed, but just above eye level. And I put my nose up against the window and I watched it disappear out over the Gulf of Mexico. And then went back to sleep. I don't know what made me wake up at 3:00 in the morning to do that. The next morning, the tower operators came in and said that they had 4 UFOs on the radar that night. And I said, "What's a UFO?" I had no idea what a UFO. They said, "Well, you should." I said, "I think I saw one." They said, "Well, you better go report it to the UFO office."
The UFO office?
Office. I said, what? So I did. I found it, and there was a captain sitting there with a multi-page questionnaire. And he questioned me very closely, and we calculated the speed from when I saw it until I saw it disappear. Came out to something like 10,000 miles an hour. That's how fast. That's what he calculated. And he wasn't at all surprised at that, which really amazed me. In any case, the very next day, I got very sick. I got something like a flu-like symptoms, with flu-like symptoms, and I had to go to the base hospital, and I was there for 3 days.
Huh.
So putting it all together, I think probably that I had been taken on board the craft, and that's why I got sick, and it all got buried in my subconscious, you know, and I didn't realize it until 2 or 3 years later.
You were an abductee, didn't even know it.
Yeah, well, what else would make me run to the window at 3 o'clock in the morning to look outside just in time to see this craft go by?
That's right.
It just made sense.
This story about Project Serpo is truly an amazing one, but let's go back to the beginning. Tell us how you got interested in it, and then explain it to everybody, Len, just what it is.
Well, my interest began with a trip to the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada in 2006. I had to take the shuttle from Laughlin to the Las Vegas airport, which was a two-hour ride, and I was sitting right behind Bill Ryan the entire time, and I was listening to him talking about the Serpo story to the person next to him for the entire 2 hours, and I just sat there with my jaw hanging down listening to him talk about it, and that's how it all started. I think you've had Bill Ryan on your program.
Sure have.
Yeah, so you know the whole story with Bill. And that got me interested, and I started doing the research. The more I dug, the more I found, I realized that there was a lot to this story. It just made sense because the amount of detail that was revealed by Anonymous was enormous. And for him to have put together that much detail, he would have been to make it all up, he would have had to be in the science fiction ranks of
Ray Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury, yeah. And Isaac Asimov,
yeah.
Combined.
Exactly. It's truly a very compelling, bizarre story.
Yes, it is.
To a lot of people who don't know what Serpo is, tell us the story.
Well, it all started with Roswell. One of the aliens survived the Roswell crash, and five of them did die in the crash. One of them survived, and he was brought to Los Alamos Laboratories, where they attempted to communicate with him, and they figured out how to communicate with him. And he also knew how to operate the communications device that was on the craft. And for a long time, the alien lived for 5 years. He lived until 1952. And for most of that time, he was not really able to get through to his home planet. But towards the end of his life, one of the scientists at Los Alamos figured out that it was necessary to reconnect the device to the craft itself, to the power source of the craft. And once they did that, it worked. And he was able to communicate with his home planet at that point. But he didn't have much time left. He died shortly thereafter, but he did send 6 messages to his home planet. At that point, nobody knew the name of the planet, knew anything about it. They gave him the name EBE number 1, standing for Extraterrestrial Biological Entity number 1.
Okay.
And one of the 6 messages that he sent to his planet suggested an exchange program. One of the messages said that told them that five of his compatriots had died in the crash and that their bodies were being kept here by us. We were keeping them in a special cryogenic facility at Los Alamos. So
was he complimentary about us?
Oh yeah, yeah, he was treated very well by us.
Okay.
The scientists were some of the top scientists in the world at that time working at Los Alamos, physicists and others of that ilk. In order to communicate with them, they brought in some top language specialists from universities around the world. It was a very difficult language to comprehend because it was like a sing-song. It was like high-pitched singing is what the way it was described. And it was very complicated. But eventually they were able to communicate about 30%. We understood about 30% of what he was communicating. And
obviously he couldn't write.
Well, he did. They did. We did get a syntax of his language, yes. He did. They do have a written language, of course.
Did we decode it?
No, but they did. They decoded our language. After trying to communicate with him for many years, just before he died, they figured the best thing to do was just to send English language lessons to his planet and let them figure it out on their end, because based on the supposition that they were probably smarter than we were. And that turned out to be the answer. And soon we were communicating in rough English back and forth. Now, it took about 10 years to iron out the kinks of this communication system. And by that time, President Kennedy was in office. Kennedy was briefed on the whole program, but he wasn't told everything. There was a lot he wasn't told. And he was the one that gave the order to go ahead with the exchange program in 1962. What he wasn't told was what had transpired between 1953 and 1962.
And what was that?
Well, in that interval, we were dealing with them on a regular basis, and they were actually helping us to reverse engineer one of their craft at the Nevada test site. Kennedy did not know that. He was not told that. CIA knew it, but he wasn't told that.
It was like the Bay of Pigs. They never told him much until it was too late.
Well, the CIA had control of the entire operation, but by that time he had started the DIA.
Mm-hmm.
And when this exchange program was okayed, he put the DIA in charge of the entire operation for obvious reasons. He wasn't getting along very well with the CIA.
Right.
I think everyone knows that.
And Dulles was there at the time, I think.
Well, right? He had already fired Dulles at that point.
Did he? Okay.
And he also fired Cabell, who was the deputy administrator.
I still think those guys were controlling things, though.
You think so?
Yeah, I do, but that's a different story.
Well, he put McCone in charge of the CIA, but the important thing was that he started the DIA, and he instilled in the DIA his concept of transparency. He wanted to make the DIA much more transparent than the CIA, because he felt that the CIA sometimes became very high-handed and that they weren't necessarily loyal to a sitting president, that they might have had an agenda of their own. So that was the reason that he and McNamara started the DIA. And that was in 1961 when he took office. So the DIA was given oversight to the entire SERPO program.
And the communication back and forth with this other race, how were they doing that?
Through the communication device that was found on the Roswell craft.
Okay.
It had a screen and it had keys, and they knew how to operate it. They had, by that time, the scientists had figured out how to operate it.
EB-1 was dead by then, right?
He died in 1952.
Okay. Carried on, I guess, the legacy of his work, and the communication started.
Yes, exactly. In any case, the aliens approved the exchange program in 1962 when it was suggested and Kennedy had picked up on it. And the date that was selected was April of 1964.
To begin?
Yes, to send their craft. They were going to send their craft here in April of 1964.
Okay. They were going to send here, drop off, and pick up?
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, between that time and 1964, Kennedy was assassinated. So he was assassinated 5 months before the first landing. Some people might think, well, maybe he intended to make it public, and some people didn't like that. I don't know. That's one of the theories floating around.
Yeah, that's true.
He was a great believer. He detested secrecy. He was a great believer in transparency, and he might have had that in mind. It's very possible. I don't know whether that had anything at all to do with his assassination, but, you know, some people have floated that as a possibility. In any case, Johnson was told about it, and he said he didn't believe it was ever going to happen, but go ahead. Go ahead with it.
Did he believe in the program? I mean, did he believe it was real?
He was skeptical. He really didn't think they were going to show up. But he said, go ahead anyway. The DIA was willing to step down and cancel the whole thing at that point because, needless to say, that everybody was in shock over the of Kennedy's assassination.
Yeah.
But Johnson agreed to go ahead with it. And so it did go ahead. And they did indeed land at Holloman Air Force Base, or just outside of Holloman Air Force Base, in April of 1964. They sent two ships.
Much like the movie Close Encounters.
It was like the movie Close Encounters. Now, that particular landing, they changed their mind and said they did not want to take the exchange, our people on their craft at that point. They said they would come back again in July of 1965, and they would pick them up at that point. But they just took the bodies of... At that point, we had 11 Ebens from their planet.
From various crashes?
From various crashes, right. There were actually two craft that crashed at Roswell, not just one.
Right, right.
And there were 10 bodies there, and 11 with EB number one, who died in 1952. So they just took the dead bodies back with them and then said they'd be coming back in...
And these were alien gray looking, right?
No, they're not grays.
All right, what do they look like?
This is a different race than the grays. The grays, my understanding is that the grays only have four fingers. The evens have five fingers,
okay.
Five toes. They look like just like miniature versions of us with a sort of an oriental looking face,
a little flare. Okay.
But with a large skull. But they were not grays.
Hairless?
Yes.
Okay.
Hairless and sort of brownish colored.
Okay.
They were like miniature, really miniature humans in a lot of ways.
Okay. Like little hobbits?
Well, I don't know. I guess you could call them hobbits, but no.
Just small people.
Small people. Small people, yeah. And very, very intelligent. I think that our team that went there at DeSerpo estimated their average IQ was about, I think they said about 180, something like that, according to Anonymous. So in any case, they did come back in July. The landing in April was a ceremonial meeting, and they presented us with an incredible gift to the people of Earth on that landing, something called the Yellow Book.
What is that?
It was a book. It wasn't really a book. It resembled a book, but it was a block of perhaps it looked like a book, but when you opened it up, holographic images sprang from the pages, and pictures and sounds in your particular language, whatever language you spoke, would come right into your mind. And Anonymous, who talked about the Yellow Book, said that it would take a lifetime to read the whole book. That's how complicated it was.
And it was a book of what?
Of history of planet Earth.
Of Earth.
Yes.
Of visitations, things like that?
Yes. Stretching back to beyond way beyond before the planet was even populated.
Almost like the Hall of Records, basically.
Exactly. Well, like the Akashic Records.
Yeah. Perhaps.
And it had a lot in common, actually, with the Akashic Records. I mean, there are some similarities. But Anonymous, who divulged the entire Serpo story, I think you know that, right?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Anonymous with you in a second, just to
see
if you can give us a better feel of who the person might have been.
Yeah, he said that you could. It would take a lifetime to read the Yellow Book. That's how complicated it was.
Well, especially if it popped up in holographic images.
Yeah, exactly. And you couldn't put a marker in the book and then pick up where you left off. You had to start over. every time you put it aside, you have to start from the beginning again. So that made it more complicated. But it was a tremendous gift to the people of Earth, and we presented them with some, I believe, some religious paintings. It's my understanding of our gift to them. I'm not sure exactly what they were, but
had they regularly been coming to the planet, Len?
Yeah, the Anonymous said they had been coming here since way before we became civilized. And according to what he said, they had made various attempts to help us develop our science and technology as best they could. But, of course, they were dealing with a very primitive people, and that wasn't easy.
What did they think of us?
I think they think that we're rather in the dark about science and technology. They're way ahead of us. Anonymous says they're probably 50,000 years ahead of us in terms of technology.
Were they concerned about our warring nature?
Actually, they themselves had a history of warfare.
It's probably the species of the universe, you know.
They had a tremendous war that lasted about 100, according to Bill Ryan, lasted about 100 of our years, in which they ultimately won by using particle beam weapons.
Hold on, Len. We're going to take this break. We're going to come right back and talk about the secret journey to planet Serpo. So much more to talk about with this incredibly fascinating story. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. My, this is an incredible story. Len Kasten with a secret journey to planet Serpo. Hey, by the way, beyond belief, have you watched the show yet? I'd like to get your feedback. You can get 10 days free. Simply sign up by going to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and then it opens up to the TV button, and then you can click that and fill it out. You also get access to their many, many other television programs and videos. And welcome back. So, Len, they're about 50,000 years ahead of us technologically, which in times of space is nothing, but that's considering what we've done in the last 100 years, that's an incredible leap, isn't it?
Yeah, and they've developed some remarkable technology, and that's how they're able to travel such a huge distance, in this case 39 light years from their planet to ours in only a matter of 9 months. So that's the kind of technology they have.
All right, so let's get back into the incredible story of Project Serpo. So at the point they haven't taken our people back yet, they've come here, they've left this holographic imaged book. What else are they doing?
In terms of what else did they do on that particular visit?
And how many visits before they decided to take people back?
The second time they came, which was July of 1965, they then came to the Nevada test site, and that's where the 12 military personnel were boarded the alien craft.
God, it's just like Close Encounters.
Yeah, it was. That particular visit, that was more like Close Encounters. That was more of a working visit. The ceremonial visit was the one in April, in which we exchanged gifts. And this particular one, our 12 people boarded the alien craft.
How long were they gone?
They were gone for 13 years. They were supposed to only be gone for 10. However, they lost track of time, they stayed for 13 years.
Did they describe what this other planet looked like and where it was and all that?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's in the Zeta Reticuli system, which is 39 light years from our solar system. And this particular planet is the fourth planet around Zeta Reticuli 2. And
were these the same beings that picked up Barney and Betty Hill originally?
No.
They're not.
Those were the Greys.
Okay.
Those were the Greys.
Okay.
The Greys, according to Anonymous, the Greys are from Alpha Centauri. They're not from Zeta Reticuli. That's what he says.
Okay.
This is in the Red Book. You know, the Red Book is a book that we keep of all of our contacts. And he said that the Greys, which some people characterize as being like the Evens, were not. They came from a planet near Alpha Centauri A. So that's different.
What was their planet like?
Well, the planet was very much like ours in terms of size and in terms of atmosphere. It was about the same diameter, 7,900 miles. The atmosphere consisted of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, just like ours. And so the air was extremely breathable by our people. But there were a very small population on that planet. Their total population was only 650,000.
On the entire planet?
On the entire planet.
How were they able to keep that at that level?
Well, they had come through a brutal war that lasted 100 years, and a lot of them had died in that battle.
Ah, they might have had millions, billions?
Who knows? Who knows?
All right.
They actually originated on a different planet entirely, according to Anonymous. That planet, their home planet, was destroyed by volcanic eruptions. And so they were forced to come to this planet, which they called Serpo.
Okay, so in the technology, I mean, they had skyscrapers, everything. Are there pictures?
No, they didn't. It was a very primitive looking planet, very much like the Southwest in America, United States.
Okay, so now we're looking back to what the Star Wars areas look like. Remember?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly like Star Wars. Yeah.
That's funny.
No, there were not skyscrapers. No, they were not.
You have this high technology, but they come back to a different kind of slower lifestyle.
Well, it was a simpler lifestyle. Let's put it that way. They did not need a lot of things that we think we need. They lived a very simple life. And everything they needed was given to them. They could get whatever they wanted at distribution sites. There was no money on Serpo. There was no cash on Serpo.
What did they want with the exchange program, Len? Were they doing this for us or for them?
You want my opinion about that?
Yeah.
It was because they were doing it for us. They were being very nice and hospitable to us, because their technology was so far in advance of ours. Of course, though, they did not have nuclear energy. They did not have that. So it could be that was something they expected to gain from us. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting that they wouldn't have it. Or maybe they had it once and bypassed it, decided not to use it anymore.
It could be, because it's kind of a crude technology, really. They used particle beam weapons in their war, and that's how they prevailed.
Yeah. How did they travel in space? What was their propulsion system?
They had several different types of propulsion. The main one, the one that allowed them to cover such huge distances so quickly, was basically traveling through wormholes. They had a grid system set up for the entire galaxy, and they knew where the wormholes started and where they ended. And once in the wormhole, they were traveling faster than the speed of light. So it was like folding. It was like they folded the distance between them and made it much shorter than it actually was.
It's like a dot to a dot on a piece of paper, and you just
exactly,
fold it over.
Exactly. Yeah. But in addition to time travel, which was absolutely necessary to travel that distance, because we're talking about 240 trillion miles. That's the distance. That's what 40 light years equates to. 240 trillion miles in a little over 9 months. So the only way that could have been accomplished was by traveling what they call superluminal, or faster than light travel. They also had antimatter propulsion built into their craft. They picked up the team in a smaller craft called a shuttlecraft, but that craft in and of itself was so huge that the Americans couldn't believe the size of it. They were in a room with about a 100-foot ceiling, they said. And we took with us 90,000 pounds of supplies and equipment, 45 tons. which was suggested, by the way, in the movie, Spielberg movie.
Were they just men that we brought, or women? Did we breed out there?
No, I don't think there was any breeding. There's some controversy over whether we took 12 women, two women or not. The consensus for most of the people who have sent in information to the website is that there were women in the original group of 16 trainees, but they were eliminated, and they did not make it through to the final 12. And my opinion is that we only sent 12 men. The two women did not go.
They did not go.
Now, I know in the movie, Spielberg has two women going, but according to what was sent, the information sent into the website by people who had trained the whole group, these are men who have trained the military personnel for the trip. The women did not make it into the final cut.
Let's talk a little bit. We'll get back to the planet. Let's talk about Anonymous, though. He was basically the source.
Yes, he was. But he was one of six. There were really six of them. They called him the DIA six. They were all members of the Defense Intelligence Agency, three active and three retired. Anonymous was the spokesman.
What else can you tell us about him?
He was the highest ranking, and he came from the highest reaches of the intelligence community. The reason I know that is because he was considered the editor of the Red Book. Did Bill Ryan discuss the Red Book with you at all?
It was a few years ago. I don't think the Red Book came up.
The Red Book is our record of all contacts with extraterrestrials. It's maintained every 5 years. It's updated with new information. Now, Anonymous was the editor of the Red Book for many, many years. As the editor of the Red Book, it was his job to brief every president. He would actually sit with the president and brief them on all changes in the Red Book. Now, if for somebody who's that high up in the intelligence community as to be briefing presidents, my own opinion is that he was probably on MJ-12. That's my opinion. I think he was a member of MJ-12.
And is probably not alive anymore.
Oh, I think he is alive still.
Do you?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was one of the retired members. There were three active and three retired. He was retired.
It's got to be what?
But he's still sending in information to the website. So he's still alive.
What's his motive?
He's aging. He wants this information out before he dies. He wants the human race to have this information. You know, when Kennedy started the DIA, it was infused with his belief in transparency. Kennedy believed in government transparency. I think you may know that. He detested government secrecy. And when he and McNamara started the DIA, they infused that organization with that ideal of transparency. And I think that these men waited the 25 years that it took to declassify this information because the final report was written in 1980, and he began sending this information in 2005. So they waited the 25 years to release this information.
And you, Len, don't have any doubts of the authenticity of the story, do you?
No, none whatsoever.
Did you have any in the beginning?
I was skeptical. I mean, it was too fantastic. It sounded like science fiction to me.
Let's
be honest. But everything checked out. He was very consistent. Everything he said was consistent. And he released an enormous amount of detail. You just can't make all this stuff up. It's too much detail. Scientific, mathematical, physics, everything. And Carl Sagan was one of the members who worked on this. So, you know, had some big names attached to it.
And give us the website address that you're talking about, that Anonymous posts on.
It's www.serpo.org.
Serpo, S-E-R-P-O.org.
Yes.
And the book, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. And the planet is called Serpo?
Well, we learned that when we got there. We didn't know what it was called till we got there. Then I think one of the aliens said, "Welcome to Planet Serpo," and that's how they knew what it was called.
When our people, was the exchange program just a one-time shot, or is it ongoing?
They've been back here to Earth 10 times since the exchange program.
And how about us over there? Just one?
As far as I know, according to the website, yes, just one.
Just that one time. Okay.
Just that one time.
That lasted 13 years. When they came back, are any of those still alive?
No, the last member of the team died in 2002 in Florida.
Okay.
Now, only seven returned, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, only seven returned.
Why? Did the others die or just want to stay?
One of them died on the way to Serpo. He had a pulmonary embolism. He was the one they called number 308. They were each given a three-digit number as an identity.
The humans were?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then on Serpo, two others died. That made three deaths. And then two of the team members decided to stay there. They didn't want to come back.
Huh.
That's right. So only seven returned. I know some people think it was eight, but it wasn't. It was seven.
Okay, and those that came back, what did they say?
Well, they were debriefed for a full year by the DIA. And out of that debriefing came a 3,000-page book. And that book is sitting in the vault at Bowling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. And that book is the book that Anonymous had access to.
Right. Did they talk about God?
I do have a chapter on the even religious beliefs in the book. Yes. Their beliefs were somewhat similar to ours.
They still looking for that answer? How? Why?
Well, they feel they have found the answers, really. They feel they do believe in reincarnation. They do believe the soul comes back. They do believe in a divine creator. So it has similarities to the Catholic faith. As a matter of fact, the Vatican, we have invited Vatican representatives to several of the several of the meetings with the Ebens.
Have they joined?
Have what?
Have they shown up?
Has who showed up? Oh, yeah.
The Vatican members.
Yeah, the last visit was in 2010. And they landed on an island in the mid-Pacific called Johnston Island, which is about the size of a big aircraft carrier, the entire island. And we had representatives from, I believe, five other nations in attendance at that meeting, including China, Russia, the Vatican, and I think two or three other nations' representatives. So, you know, we have been inviting other nations to these meetings.
Now, how do we know we can trust Anonymous? That he's not like a disinformation expert or something?
You know, as I said before, you know, you take this enormous amount of detail. I think it's like 13,000 words, something like that. And he would have had to be a science fiction writer of the first order to put this together. And
who'd want to spend this kind of time doing
it? And who'd want to spend this kind of time? I mean, why would he do this? What would his motive be? Here is an aging intelligence operative, a career intelligence man who's decided that this story is so important to the human race that he's going to get it out there. And that's what happened. That's my belief.
Well, and he's been doing it.
And he has been doing it. Now, the reason I wrote the book, I have to say this, my feeling was that the website could go away in an instant. You know, it takes is one instant to take down a website.
You hack it and that's it.
And then what happens to all this information? So I felt that the book had to be written just to make sure that this information did not get lost and that all this information and all of the work these men did was not in vain. And that's really why I wrote the book. And the publisher agreed with me.
What did our team members eat out there? Now I'm getting into some strange, curious stuff.
They took a lot of sea rations with them. They took about They thought they had 10 years worth of sea rations, but it only lasted 5 years. And they eventually had to start eating the alien food. They didn't like it. It tasted like paper, they said.
What was it? Like plants or animals or what?
Mainly vegetation, yeah. The Evens had a very sophisticated hydroponics setup on their planet for growing food. And I think you know that hydroponics relies mainly on water.
That's right.
And soil. And
it was a water planet too, like us?
No, it was mainly land, actually.
Okay.
We eventually got accustomed to eating their food, and because they ran out of sea rations. And in my book, I have 13 appendices, and one of the appendices gives everything they brought with them. The 90,000 pounds of equipment and the food that they brought with them. So it's all detailed in the back of the book.
We'll talk more, Len, when we come right back on Coast to Coast Day. It's called The Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Len Kasten's our guest. We're going to talk more about this incredible exchange program when we come back on Coast to Coast Day. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Len Kasten with us with this really incredible story of Project Serpo, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. When you were putting the book together, Len, which was basically in the event something happened to the website, we still would have a record of this incredible journey. Any pictures ever come your way of what these beings look like or their planet or anything like that?
The team took 3,000 photos on Serpo. Of those 3,000 photos, which are all in the vault at Bowling Air Force Base, only one has emerged, and that is in the book. It's a photo of the two suns in the sky. It's a vista of the planet, which is kind of barren, really, but you do see the two suns in the sky. That's in the book.
It's a binary star system.
Binary star system, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there was no darkness on Serpo. It never got fully dark. The team had a difficult time getting used to that because one of the suns was always in the sky.
Did they leave behind any heirs that may have the story and carry it on here?
What, the team members?
Yeah, on this planet?
No, they were selected. They were originally selected because they wanted them totally unattached.
Ah.
They wanted them unmarried. Preferably, they wanted them to be orphans themselves. They did not want them to have any children. They wanted them to be totally unattached. Now, the reason for that, I guess, is that in the event they didn't come back, they wanted to bring grief to as few people as possible. I'm not sure what the reason was.
Was there a problem between a team commander and one of these Evans or the doctor or something?
Yeah, there was a confrontation. That's right.
What happened?
Well, one of the team members died on the way to Serpo. It was the one they call number 308. He was a pilot. There were two pilots.
That's the one with a pulmonary problem?
Pulmonary embolism. Now, when they got to Serpo, the team commander asked for his body. They wanted to give it a proper burial. The Eben doctor said they could not give him the body. And he said, why not? They said, because we don't have it anymore. He said, what do you mean you don't have it anymore? That body belongs to planet Earth. We have religious rituals that we follow when somebody dies. They said, well, the body has been used to clone other creatures. Well, this caused a great confrontation to the point where the commander was ready to go get the guns to open the case where he thought the body was there. And eventually they all calmed down. And the team commander acknowledged that would we come all this distance to get into a fist fight with aliens? It didn't make sense. So they all backed down. And in order to back down, they were given an audience with the doctor in charge, the alien doctor. And he explained to them what they did with the body and how they used it to create an entity that was part human and part Eben. And
I wonder what it looked like.
The team commander asked to be taken to see this entity, and they did. They brought him into this building where they had all the biotechnology creatures, horrible creatures. Some of them were horrible. And they let him see the clone that they had created. And the commander was so revolted that he said in his diary, he said, "I have seen the dark side of this civilization." But see, he didn't understand. When they went to Serpo, this, it was 1965, and in 1965, DNA technology, biotechnology, was not very far advanced on our planet. So he didn't really know what it was all about. And so he viewed it as something evil rather than something technological. They viewed it as just technology. They were simply experimenting with creatures that they had brought back from other planets that they had visited. They had creatures there from many, many other planets. And the one that they created from the body of 308 was just another one of those.
Yeah, but I could tell how the guy would feel revolted by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I would too. I'm sure I would.
The guy was probably his friend. You know?
Yeah, it was his friend. Absolutely. He was a pilot. So he was sickened by it. And he wrote about it in his diary. And in any case, both sides backed down and got realistic about what they were doing.
Did they ever talk about what caused the crashes here on this planet?
You know, not on the Serpo website per se, but Anonymous did mention that two alien craft crashed, collided over Roswell. I think that probably Linda Moulton Howe also mentioned that, didn't she, when you talked to her?
Yes, sure did.
Yeah, and one of them crashed about 75 miles north of Roswell. Another one crashed in the plains of St. Augustine, which was far to the west.
That's right.
And apparently it had something to do with the radar. We had some very powerful radar in New Mexico. The combination of the radar and the lightning storm, I think, is what disoriented the craft, and that's why they crashed.
Why did they take so long and not come back and get them? Did they not know where they were? What happened?
Why did they take so long to
get them? Yeah, I mean, you would think there would have been a rescue operation.
Yeah, and the alien that sent the messages to his home planet did request a rescue operation. Now, don't forget that he sent that message in 1952.
Right.
Okay? We did not do the exchange program until 1964. That was 12 years later. A lot went on in those 12 years, and my belief is, and I have a chapter in the book on this subject, that They did send another craft back down to Earth, and they did help us to reverse engineer our own craft, and they worked with us for 10 years at the Nevada test site, and that's the reason we were not hesitant about sending these 12 men across the galaxy, because by that time we knew a lot about that civilization. And we had already worked with them for 10 years. But Kennedy did not know that. He was not privy to that information.
Well, when Kennedy, you know, was assassinated, there was talk that he had whispered a few of these secrets to Marilyn Monroe. That might have been the reason she got killed. Who knows? Did you hear any of that?
You know, there were a lot of people that wanted Kennedy dead. You know, there were so many that he had antagonized because he was so idealistic and he was not very pragmatic. He was trying to do the right thing, and a lot of the people did not want him to do the right thing. And he had James Meredith accompanied to school to break the prejudice against the blacks. That was another thing, another reason they didn't care for what he was doing. But I do think that the Serpo story may have had something to do with it. I'm not sure.
What more can you tell us about the history of this race, the Ebens?
Well, according to what Anonymous says about the Yellow Book, their entire history is in that book. And that's That's all we know, is that they escaped from their own planet, which was destroyed by volcanic eruptions, and they just moved the entire population to Serpo. And they were involved in a 100-year war, and that's pretty much all we found out that was reported by Anonymous.
And you say they're still coming here. Are they trying to gather information? Are they involved in this hybridization program or anything like that?
No, they're not involved in the hybridization program, and they don't do any abductions. Now, we have a very good relationship with the Ebens.
These are the good ones, I guess.
These are the good guys. We have a very, very, very good diplomatic relationship with the Ebens, and we've exchanged some very incredible technologies. But, of course, it's been kept suppressed and secret.
Sure. Did they ever talk about different kinds of life forms in this universe?
According to Anonymous, in his introduction, in the Red Book, he said that nine different civilizations we've been visited by nine different civilizations. He said we did have visitors from nine other star systems. He said the Greys, which some people characterize as being like the Ebens, were not Ebens. They came from a planet near Alpha Centauri. Third class of visitors came from a G2 star system in Leo. Another class of visitors came from a G2 star system in Epsilon Eridani. And there were nine different races that came here that we know about, that he knew about.
But some of them were pretty evil, weren't they?
No, actually not. None of the ones that he mentioned, according to the... Some races that have come here have been hostile. Yes, yes, some have been.
No doubt. I mean, David Jacobs talks about that, and some of the other races have been abductions, haven't
those
they?
Those are the Greys. The Greys are the race that supposedly has been doing all the abducting, but not the Ebens.
Did they explain why those Ebens were even here in the first place?
Well, they've been visiting our planet for thousands of years. So they've been watching us develop slowly but surely over long periods of time, and all of that was in the Yellow Book.
Must have been an interest, though, with our nuke facilities, huh?
Well, evidently, because they were surveilling our facilities over the 509th Bomb Group, which was the nuclear bomb group in Roswell, and also the nuclear facility in Sandia and Albuquerque, all that whole area was the heart of our military industrial complex. So they were obviously checking out everything.
Have they branched out to a point, Len, where they go to other regions of this planet, or do they just visit us? Were we the lucky ones?
As far as I know, we are their connection with planet Earth, according to what Anonymous says. But we have invited other nations to these rendezvous. And as I said, China, Russia, the Vatican were invited to the last meeting at the Johnson Island in the mid-Pacific. So according to this, the People's Republic of China, the Russian Federation, the Vatican, United Nations, and many, many representatives of different areas of our government were all in attendance at the last meeting.
Would they step in, Len, if someone was going to launch nukes? Would they disarm them?
Would the aliens disarm them?
Yeah.
I don't think they would take any action that we did not agree to. No, I don't think so. We now have a diplomatic relationship with the Eben civilization, much like a diplomatic relationship that we would have with another country. And that means that everything is negotiated, of course. They're not going to take any one-sided action, no. That's my opinion.
Well, you may be right. What other technologies have they helped us with?
Well, of course, I'm quite convinced that they've helped us with anti-gravity technology. They had a sort of what we consider a helicopter here. They had a similar kind of aerial device that did not have rotating blades, but just was anti-gravity that they used to get around the planet. And the team members said they found a way that they were able to adapt to using it very easily. That they were given their own aircraft to use as they saw fit. So they had anti-gravity technology both not only in aircraft, but also in vehicles. The vehicles floated above the ground. They did not actually have tires. They were anti-gravity as well. There were some other things. They had the ability to view events in time, to go backwards in time. And that was how the Yellow Book came to be. Some other technologies, they had acoustical weapons that they told us about. They had the ability to communicate from star to star, interstellar communications. We developed something from that called Project GLEAM, GLEAM, which is a highly classified project that deals with direct communication with SERPO.
Which is ongoing?
Yeah, ongoing. It's a high-speed sending system allowing a beam to be propelled at enormous speeds. Los Alamos is involved with it, and also some other military contractors are involved with it.
Are we using any of this propulsion system today, any of this technology today for our own benefit, or do we keep it on?
Are you asking my opinion?
Yeah.
My opinion is yes. Can I prove it? No. it's top secret, of course.
I mean, I've always wondered if we can use it in warfare, why haven't we? Or have we?
Use what?
Any kind of technology that they've got. For the advantage.
Well, I already discussed with you particle beam weapons, right?
Right, right.
I'm convinced we have particle beam weapons, and whether or not we got that technology from the Evens, I'm not sure, because we were already working on it by 1965. We were already working on it. But particle beam weapons are high-powered devices that just send a beam of energy and can take apart any target at a molecular level. This, I believe, we do have, and I think they're mounted on satellites, and probably the Soviets have it as well. That's my guess.
How far is Zeta Reticuli from us?
The
way they travel, it's an instant, isn't it?
The Zeta Reticuli star system is 38.4 light years away.
Okay.
Almost 39 light years.
But with their propulsion system, it doesn't mean anything, does it?
Yeah, exactly. They do the trip in 9 months. But that's 240 trillion miles. So.
Do we know if the two who stayed behind are still alive, or did they die?
Okay, according to Anonymous, we maintained the communications device that the alien first used to communicate with SERPO was still intact when our team got there. So it's my understanding, even though Anonymous doesn't talk about it in detail, that they did use that device to communicate with Earth while they were there. And according to what Anonymous says, the two that remained behind did communicate with us until 1988. The team returned in 1978. But the two that remained behind did continue to communicate with Earth until 1988, and all communication ceased at that point. So we don't know what happened to them.
The name of the book, of course, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Anything surprising for you, Len, when you were putting this together?
Well, the whole story is remarkable, actually.
Sure is.
What surprised me the most, I think, was the fact that the Evens had been able to develop hybrid creatures that were part even and part, they call them cloned biological entities. And they did bring some of them here for us to study.
Did they just meld into society?
No. They're kept under military supervision.
Would they look like us, or did they still look a little strange?
Oh, they look strange.
Okay. Stay with us, Len. Coming back for more with you on Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to take some of your calls as we talk about Project Serpo, the incredible story as well. Hey, by the way, those of you who live in the greater Los Angeles area, a little benefit going on. The California Earthquake Authority, KFI AM 640, and the American Red Cross joining forces to send an urgent message to Get Prepared California. It is an initiative to help prepare the state for the next damaging disaster and to raise money for this important cause. From now until this Friday, we're auctioning off dinner with me at Morton's in Burbank following a tour of the KFI studios. In June, a pair of tickets goes to the highest bidder. Also, you'll take home a 21-piece platinum cookware set. Go bid. Go to KFIAM640.com. That's KFIAM640.com. In the search up there, put in Red Cross. That opens up. Click auction. Scroll all the way down and outbid the best bidder so we can do all this. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Len, did they ever have problems with their own planet in terms of running out of resources or anything like that? Did they go there?
Say that again, George.
Did they ever have problems, depleting their own resources or anything like that?
You mean in which case they would have to use our resources?
Maybe, yeah.
Not as far as I know. That wasn't mentioned by Anonymous. By the way, there was a very important piece of technology that I failed to mention. They do have free energy. Anonymous said that, quote, they are able to tap into a vacuum and bring back an enormous amount of energy from that vacuum. So that's probably the most important piece of technology that we learned about on Serpo, because if they did indeed share that with us, and we have that technology, just think of the implications.
But will we ever use it?
Well, we would use it, probably, but it's not commercially viable at this point.
They don't know how to make money on it for us. So.
Exactly. In other words, we're still living in our oil-based economy.
And then once they do, it's not free energy anymore.
Exactly. But since they do have that, and they probably did share that technology with us, just think of the possibilities.
Let's go to some of the phones. Tom in Farmington, Missouri, welcome to the program. Hi, Tom.
Why, hello, George.
Great.
I'm a first-time caller. Good. Glad to hear from you.
Good to have you with us.
I was wondering, what brought these guys here in the first place? Were they just exploring the galaxy, or did they need something from another planet? And my second question was, in the last half hour, the guest said that all communications had ceased in 1988 with these guys. Have they ever restored that communication, and why not? And just a quick comment, I think you ought to take the lead on trying to ban all pressure cookers, George.
After that, I'll just listen offline.
Thanks.
All right. Well, let's start with number two first. Have they ever reconnected communication-wise, Len?
Yeah, the communications with the Evens has continued. The last visit was in 2012. So we've been communicating with them constantly ever since. And we've developed this high-speed interstellar communication system, which I mentioned, that pushes a communications beam at extremely high speed across the galaxy. So at this point, we're communicating with them on a regular basis, and that's why they've been back 10 times.
You mentioned that, of course, they've been here for a very, very long time. But what was their initial reason recently, when this happened?
According to Anonymous, they are explorers. They explore the entire galaxy. They've been to many, many other planets. He talks about the fact that they have been in touch with many other civilizations in our galaxy.
That's a great planet to visit, isn't it?
Yes. I would think they would, because their planet is not very pretty. It's actually very dull, and also they have what we discovered to be a sort of a police state on that planet. They're very regimented, and they're very controlled. That's the other point I wanted to bring up. They don't have the kind of freedoms that we have here. So we're ahead of them on that score. They didn't have a Thomas Jefferson like we did.
Back to the phones. Let's go to Muskova. Or Muskoka, Canada, International Line. Hey, David, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good. All is well.
Great. I just wondered if they discussed anything about curing cancer or cystic fibrosis or any other medical cures and all this and offline things.
All right, you got that. Any help in terms of that kind of technology, Len, to rid ourselves of any of these afflictions?
Absolutely. They had the most very sophisticated biotechnology. I don't think they had any aches and pains at all on the planet that we were able to discover. We were not able to discover any sickness at all on their planet. So whatever they're doing, they know what they're doing. Their biotechnology is so sophisticated that they can literally, if they can create clones that are part human, part even, and part machine, then they can do just about anything.
Let's go to Alan in Florida, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the – well, he's not ready yet. Let's go west. Phil in Malala, Oregon. Go ahead, Phil.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Okay, my question's for Len. My question is, have you ever heard of the Ronald Reagan briefing on SERPO?
Yeah, I have a whole chapter in my book on that briefing.
Explain that for us, Len.
Okay, well – the Ronald Reagan briefing was done in March of 1981 by a CIA member who called himself the caretaker. And he talked all about the Roswell crash and about Project SERPO. So Reagan was briefed completely on all of this material in 1981 by the CIA. And that's in my book.
Did every standing president eventually know about all of this?
No, not at all. As I said, they kept a lot of information from Kennedy.
He was in the dark, but he picked up on it toward the end before he died, right?
Well, I don't think he ever knew what happened in that 10-year period between 1952 and 1962. I don't think he was ever briefed on that.
Johnson was. What about Carter, Nixon?
I think they all had pieces of it. I think Nixon did, too. I think Eisenhower was the last president that was thoroughly briefed on this, but the others were given pieces of information as MJ-12 decided they saw fit. That's my opinion.
What did their craft look like, Len?
Well, you know, I don't know what the configuration was, what they looked like from the distance, but the team commander said that he was standing in a room with a ceiling that was 100 feet high. We sent 10 combat motorcycles and 3 Jeeps into their craft, and it hardly even filled up a corner of the craft. 90,000 pounds of equipment hardly even made it.
You still there? Oh, we lost him. We'll get him right back here for you in just a second. He's gone. Let's go to Dave in Radcliffe, Iowa, first-time caller. Dave, let's do a little chat until we get back.
Yeah, I wanted to find out about the computers and stuff and how they went around in the 60s and the technology through the years. Is that how we got a lot of our technology?
Well, a lot of people say that. In Bill Burns' book, The Day After Roswell, which was about the late Colonel Philip Corso, they claim that they had given us reverse engineered technology and that that's something that he then went to companies at the time to have, like, the computer chip made,
right,
and things like that. So, you know, that's possible because there was a jump in technology from
right,
a certain period.
To the 60s to the 80s.
Yeah.
And we got technology
huge.
And aerodynamics.
Yep, it was
it just
huge.
It went to the sky.
Yep, absolutely. Len, you missed the call, but what the caller Dave wanted to know was, that gap of technology that we got from them, it must have been huge, huh? Len? Well, he's not there again. So this is going to be an interesting moment, isn't it? Let's go to Roanoke, Virginia. Derek on the wild card line. Derek, welcome to the show.
George, can't keep the fish on the line, can you?
No, it just keeps wiggling off.
I'll tell you what, I'll get you a nightcrawler on there. It'll bite, I'll tell you what. But I just had a question for him. I want to know what the aliens sound like. What's their language like?
Well, in this case, he said it was like a high-pitched singing sound that they were only able to decipher just a little bit. Let's go to Nathan in Louisiana. Go ahead, Nathan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good. And I think we got Len back on for a little bit.
Oh, good. I had a question. I don't know if I missed it. I was bringing my daughter back from the hospital. What my question was there any problem with them wondering if we would actually use their technology against them?
Len?
No, we have a very friendly relationship with the Evens. Anonymous says they're a very caring and considerate people, and we have probably a better relationship with them than we have with any other extraterrestrial race.
Okay, and also I wanted to confirm that you were talking about particle beam weapons.
Yes.
My dad worked for the Department of Navy Intelligence back in 1981, working on the Star Wars project.
Oh.
And we went to Washington, D.C. with him, and he had a briefcase with a chain handcuffed to his wrist.
Oh, boy.
And he left his briefcase on the counter. He was taking a shower, and we saw something called brilliant pebbles, high particle hydrogen beam weapon or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I've got to confirm that's true.
I think absolutely we do have particle beam weapons. I'm convinced we do, and I believe they're mounted on satellites. Whether other nations have them or not, I don't know.
How close was the Tesla technology, Len, to what we were finally given from the Evans?
Very close. Tesla called it a death ray, and it was the same principle. It was a very high-powered beam of a single atom in length, in width, that packed such a punch that it could literally disassemble people at the it could disassemble machinery and people at the molecular level. And that's what particle beam weapons are.
Let's go to DeWitt, Iowa. Dan's with us now. Hey, Dan, take it away.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
The guest keeps referring to the exchange of technologies. I'm just wondering, these people came from the stars to this planet, what could we possibly have that we could exchange with them?
Well, they're interested in our biology. They're interested in the who we are. They're not interested in our technology. Apparently, we have certain characteristics in our built into our DNA that interest them very much.
Are we that unique, Len?
Well, let's just say that we're quite advanced when it comes to that, I believe. And I think that's what they find so interesting on this planet. Because I don't know whether you know this or not, but there were human body parts on the Roswell craft. They were taking human body parts back to their planet. That's what they were doing here.
Where did they get them?
From dead people somewhere.
They dig them up or something?
Cemeteries, I don't know. But that was kept secret for a long time. But Colonel Corso did know about that. And that's why Corso came to the conclusion that they were hostile. And that I think he thought they were actually human flesh eaters. But it turns out, when we got to Serpo, that really they have such a highly developed biotechnology, they were taking them back for study. And they've been doing this on other planets throughout the galaxy. So that's what they're interested in. They're not interested in any other kind of technology.
Did they talk about how many other planets might be inhabited?
Tons of them. Tons of planets are inhabited. Absolutely. They've been all over the galaxy.
You know, now, Len, people are seeing these large triangular-shaped objects. Do we know where they're coming from?
Well, according to some stuff that I've read, we build them ourselves. I think that came out several years ago. Didn't Ben Rich talk about that or somebody?
Maybe the smaller versions, but the big ones, I'm not sure they're ours.
How big are they?
A mile long?
What's that?
A mile long?
A mile long. I don't know. I don't know if we build those or not. I don't know. But I know that we do have anti-gravity triangular craft, and we've had them for some time.
Let's go to Pocatello, Iowa. It's Leon's turn on Coast to Coast. Leon, go ahead.
Hey, I had two questions. First question is, you keep saying they won the war with these particle weapons. What was it, a civil war, or was it, like, against another race? And second was, what kind of, like, animals, if anything, did they see? Like, what kind of predators and herbivores did they see out there?
All right.
On Serpo? What kind of animals are on Serpo? Is that the question?
Yes.
There were several strange animals on Serpo. One was a snake-like creature that had very highly developed eyes. The eyes were very similar to human eyes. And the team commander actually got permission to kill this creature so they could take it apart and look at it. And they did give us that permission. But then when we wanted to eat the meat, that's where they drew the line and said, no, you can't eat it. But there were other creatures that were also strange. There were some armadillo-like creatures that seemed dangerous, but the serpos just scared them away with acoustical devices. And there were others.
Do you think the exchange program was worth it?
For us or for them?
Either one.
Absolutely. Look at what we learned. It opened the gateway to the galaxy for us. We now have friends on a planet that's 40 light years away, and that has a relationship with many, many other civilizations. This is tremendous. How could we not benefit from this?
Why did we stop going there with them, going to their planet?
In their spaceships, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really know. I think that we learned all we needed to learn, and we had all the information we wanted. There was no point to it. It's not a very pleasant place.
It's like the moon program. Once you're there, that was it.
Exactly, exactly. It's not as though they have these beautiful crystal cities that we see in science fiction movies. It was a kind of a dull planet, really. They lived in adobe-type structures, and they lived very simple lives.
But they had great flying machines.
Had great flying machines. That's right. Anti-gravity.
Costa Mesa, California. Matt's turn. Hey, Matt, go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good, Matthew.
Good. I actually just have two probably comments. Based on the information your guest has given tonight, it seems to me that the quickest their rescue team could get here would be 38.5 years plus the 9 months it takes to get here. And secondly, the lack of bookmark in the yellow book just seems kind of weird to me. We've had iPads for about 5 years, and they have bookmarks. Just wanted to see what he would say about that.
Okay. And in terms of propulsion, you were talking about they've learned how to bend space and time, Glenn, correct?
Exactly. Regarding the rescue mission, is that the question?
Well, he wants to know about that book.
Oh, about the book. Well, the book was Anonymous said that it would take a lifetime to read that book. Take a lifetime.
Okay. Len, thank you. The name of the book, of course, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. It is available for you. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Another hour to go of Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back. Len, thanks for being on the program.
Okay, boys. I hope you all have heard all that stuff. That's very, very interesting. The first time I've ever heard that particular story. We got quite a bit of this information on UFOs and aliens and cars and Illuminati and the ancient bloodlines and stuff on this planet. lot of this stuff can be found in the places over the internet. But I try to gather the best and the most important information, especially the technology on particle weapons and the
full open lines for you now this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you who might not have heard one of my lead stories at the top of the program, of course, the TSA has listened to those of us who have some sanity left, and they have decided to table for now knives on planes. It was supposed to take effect Thursday, where you'd be able to carry on a 2.36-inch knife. Unbelievable. But they, because of pressure from flight attendants, air marshals, us, you, they've decided to hold off for a little bit. Let's hope it's a permanent holding off. Anyway, we're going to come back in a moment. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Hour to go of open lines here for you on Coast to Coast AM. Lots going on tonight. By the way, Stephen Greer unveiled his film Sirius. He's going to be our guest with Paula Harris tomorrow, along with Major Ed Dames, talking about some of his remote viewing thoughts. And, of course, you know, he sees a lot of strange things going on with North Korea, but we'll get to the bottom of that with Ed Dames tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go to the phone. Seth is in Greensboro, North Carolina. Get us started. Hey, Seth, what's up?
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Not
anymore, though. Let's go to San Francisco. Fred, welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi. So I've had about 4 experiences with UFOs and 1 up close, about 30 feet above me with my entire family, and was there for quite a while. And so what I was wondering is how come I've had so many experiences? I'm only 20 now, and, you know, some people only get 1 or none. Like, is there any reason for some people getting a lot of experiences, or...
You know what? 1, you could be just in the right place at the right time. But the other thing is, you could be the chosen one. You know, they could be wanting you to see them more so than other people. You know, some people have thought that those people who have more UFO visions and sightings might have been, you know, abducted as youngsters, and they keep coming back.
I hope you all enjoyed.
That's all very possible. Very possible. I mean, it's like winning the lottery. Some people seem to win the lottery more than other people. I don't know how that happens, but it does.
I'm going to have to. The first time I saw him, I was like, I think 6 years old. Since I was a kid.
Well, you know, Fred, let me ask you this. Could you see any structure to it or texture?
Yeah. I actually remember 3 of them with really good detail. And the one that I saw with my family was triangular with lights on each corner, 1 in the center, completely silent, about 30 feet above us, and it was huge. It was like about half the size of a football field, to my recollection. And then the other one that I saw was a ball with a cone mist coming out of the back of it.
Jeez.
And it was flying overhead for a while, and then it just kind of vanished.
And I'm sure you think for a moment, okay, is that ours? Could we make something of that? And then once you get out of that, then it really becomes exciting and chilling, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I envy you. You know, the ones I saw were up so high, they just looked like 2 little dots zipping all over the place. Cleveland, Ohio, we go. AJ, good morning.
Hi, how are you, George?
Good, AJ.
I've always been interested in the occult. Occult is simply a word meaning hidden. And so much of our powers in this world and the way things work are hidden. And I've always been interested in the occult. Occult is simply a word meaning hidden. And so much of our powers in this world and the way things work are hidden. And the more one looks at this subject of how the world actually works, you begin to see that there's a magical system, and I'm telling you, there really is a magical system dominating the world of the Western civilization. To go to the basis, the fundamental foundation on which things sit, in order to understand, begin to see how magical use of words and terms and symbols are used, you need to start looking at the world of the occult in politics and religion.